Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Nell Freudenberger about her new novel, The Newlyweds.
There used to be something called Asian Euro. It's now called Asian Dating. You know, it's a site where people who are interested in marriage from very different parts of the world come together, and often it's Asian women and European or American men.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. T.M. Lerman takes us inside the world of American evangelicals.
The pastor tells you to set out a second cup of coffee for God in the morning, so it makes it easier for you to talk to God over your coffee.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Nell Freudenberger is one of America's most distinguished and admired novelists. She has a new book. It's called The Newlyweds. It's reviewed on our cover by Mohsen Hamid, who says that Freudenberger has a powerful sense of empathy and clear-eyed openness and compassion toward the world. I'm delighted that Nell is here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Nell, this is a novel about two people from opposite poles of experience who come together and are married in an unusual way and have an unusual life together. And it's based on a real incident. Tell us about it.
Well, I was flying from Manhattan, from New York City up to Rochester, where my grandmother had just passed away. And I found myself sitting next to a young woman and a man I thought was her husband. It turned out they were only engaged at that point. I believed she was Indian, but it turned out that she was from Bangladesh. And I happened to be reading an Amitav Ghosh novel called The Hungry Tide that took place in the Sundarbans, in the estuarine southern part of Bangladesh, and that extends into India. I was curious about her and sort of looking for a way to start a conversation, which is kind of unusual for me because I'm usually pretty unsociable. She actually started talking to me, and she asked about the book, and I told her where it took place, and she said that she—
About the book you were reading?
The book I was reading, and she said that she had actually been born in a village in the Sundarbans, and that coincidence was what sort of started our five-year conversation that really led to this book.
I mean, because you've got her on a plane flying from New York to Rochester, which is upstate. Actually, I have family in Rochester, western New York.
Right.
It's not a very long flight, and she's seated next to a man you thought was
her husband.
Well,
he was clearly American, and they were holding hands. You know, they seemed
like a couple,
like newlyweds, and they were actually not quite married yet. I myself was engaged at that point, so I was interested in, interested in couples and marriage. And we ended up starting to email each other. At first, I was just struck by how different their courtship was from mine and my husband's.
Okay, so now we get to the novel, and we have two characters.
Amina and George.
And George is from Rochester. Amina is from Bangladesh. And how do they meet?
Well, their story, the way that they meet is similar to my friend who I met on that flight. They find each other on a website called AsianEuro.com.
And you made that up, right? Or is there such a thing?
There used to be something called Asian Euro. It's now called Asian Dating. But it's a site where people who are interested in marriage from very different parts of the world come together. And often in 90% of the cases, it's Asian women and European or American men. But there are cases where it's reversed. It's certainly not a mail order bride site. I've heard this. That's not really the case. I mean, these are two people who, for very different reasons, went on this site and, you know, were looking for each other.
Well, and they develop a relationship over email.
They
but
do.
They haven't met at this point.
They do. And they write to each other for 11 months. And he comes to Bangladesh to meet her. And it's his first trip out of the country. And when she comes eventually to wed him, it's her the first time she's left Bangladesh. So my friend said to me, Bangladesh was my husband's first country and America was mine. And that sentence kind of lodged itself in my brain. And I mean, there's always a moment when you think, and usually with a sinking heart, you think this is going to be the book I write. And for me, it's always the sort of discouraging part of it is that it's always something that seems as if it's going to be impossible to write, that I don't have the background, basically, to do what I want to do. And yet, I think I knew when I got off the plane that I wanted to write about this woman. I don't know why, but I knew it.
So what kind of, it isn't an imposing task. I mean, you have to create, invent a plausible character from Bangladesh. How do you do that as a writer?
Well, you need to do some research. And I think, you know, in this case, I was really lucky because I had somebody who was willing to almost collaborate with me on this project. I mean, we, in a way, we had this interview that lasted for 5 years and, you know, quickly became a friendship. But she was interested in the idea of me writing the book, and she wanted to help me with it. She wanted it to be accurate. We actually made a plan to go and visit her family in the Sundarbans before I knew I was even going to write the book. And that trip was enormously useful, obviously, just for putting me in the physical places that appear in the novel, in her parents' apartment in Dhaka and the village that where she was born, where her grandmother lived.
Now, this raises an interesting question as well. I think listeners will wonder, okay, you befriend this obviously very interesting young woman. You have a real connection with her. You're going to tell a novel that draws in some way on her experiences, but you're not writing a biography of her, and you also have to have the license as a fiction writer to invent.
Well,
a lot,
and that was
right?
really my anxiety, because everything, more or less obviously, everything I write comes from something that I've heard, and most often it's a story that someone tells me that, preferably something that's not fleshed out, something about a friend of a friend, something my parents told me a long time ago when I was a kid that then I sort of, that lodged.
You kind of imagine yourself into, in a way.
Exactly. And the more, the easier it is to imagine, the less you know, the easier it is to imagine. And so that's why I sort of thought that this project, while I was drawn to it, would never work, because I was in constant touch with her and I loved hearing about her process of assimilation in Rochester. I mean, I would have taken that over writing the book. I wasn't going to say to her, okay, now I'm going to write a book. Don't write to me anymore. I mean, the more she wrote to me, the more interested I was.
So now let's talk a little more about the novel. So we have Amina and George, and they are adjusting. It's kind of a novel of the moment, the clash of different cultures and civilizations. There's tension to the Muslim world and Muslim values. And your character, Amina, is making her way, right? She looks for a job. She gets a driver's license. Is that experience of assimilation in America, that's still an ongoing rich source of for narratives for a novelist?
I mean, what was interesting to me about it was how different it is for her than, you know, it would have been for someone in her parents' generation. Because, you know, it's less clear that this way of life is absolutely desirable. I mean, I think in the novel there's another character of it from a very different class, an Indian man who comes here to go to business school and then decides to go back because the opportunities are all on the other side. In Rochester, Rochester was a place I knew, so it was useful in that way, but also it's a place where, you know, huge corporations have recently really foundered, Xerox and Kodak, and, you know, these giants that made my
George
grandparents.
George Eastman was this giant figure, casts a huge shadow over all of Rochester. And
well, my grandparents were real patriots of Rochester. They wouldn't allow you to say anything, you know, anything negative about it. And I think, you know, this troubles, that the economic troubles that the city has had were, you know, relevant to the story.
Okay. And then you kind of reverse the current and we go back to Bangladesh. And what does George, the American, see there?
In the novel, he doesn't go back.
Oh, right, because she just met him the first time.
Right, he goes the first time, and I think, you know, he probably sees what any American who had never, you know, never left the country, much less gone as far as that. I mean, Bangladesh is a place that feels, you know, it feels really different in the way that India might have, you know, if you had gone in the 70s.
And why does Amina go back?
She goes back to because she would like to help her parents return to the United States. She wants to bring
here.
Them back, and she's finally convinced George, her husband, that that might work. At first he's completely opposed, and then they sort of strike a bargain. But there are some hurdles that come up once they get to Bangladesh in terms of her parents returning with her, and so that's sort of the conflict in the last third of the book.
So has your friend now read the entire novel?
She has, yeah, she has, and her husband has. Her husband was also really accommodating. He told me that he was happy to be he was happy to inspire a character as long as I would make him a little bit taller in the book.
Thanks so much, Nell.
Thank you.
That's Nell Freudenberger, whose new novel, The Newlyweds, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, Whitney Houston, gone, but by no means forgotten.
There are plenty of books about Whitney Houston, and the latest one is being shopped this week by her mother, the gospel singer Sissy Houston. She has met with several publishers this week in a suite at the St. Regis Hotel, and she's described this book as the real and definitive story of her daughter, who of course died in February in Beverly Hills at the age of 48.
So this is a story then, or a book that's not really written, it's an idea for a book, and publishers will be competing for it. Do you have a sense of just how strong a hold on the public Whitney Houston has? I mean, will there be serious interest in this?
It seems to me that there would be enormous interest in a book by a family member of Whitney Houston, especially someone who was as close to her as her mother was. The big question, I think, for a book like this is how candid is her mother willing to be about Whitney Houston's death, about her many years of drug use. Sissy Houston was always known in the music industry as someone who was incredibly supportive of her daughter. You know, this wasn't the kind of situation with, say, Michael Jackson and his family. You know, she was very close to her, didn't speak badly about her in the press. So you have to assume that a book about her daughter would be told very lovingly and admiringly. So I think that's the big question for publishers. How candid is she willing to get, and what kind of book are they going to get?
And if you have any sense, have you had a chance? I know this is a new story. Have you had a chance to talk to publishers or agents or get any sense of what story she means to tell? Or?
Well, the publishers I spoke to who were in on these meetings with Sissy Houston said that she didn't seem very eager to address her daughter's death, and that there was a feeling in the air that no one really wanted to go there, that asking Ms. Houston directly about her daughter's drug use would not have been a welcome question. So I think now that publishers have met with her and spoken with her about this book, that's probably going to be one of the questions that they follow up with Ms. Houston about, you know, what kind of book are they going to get? Naturally, there will be a ghostwriter involved with this book. Sissy Houston is 78 years old. The publishers I spoke to said that she seemed like she had a cloud of grief over her head. She seemed emotionally and physically drained. You know, she spoke about her daughter very lovingly and called her Nippy, which was her childhood nickname.
And Julie, Whitney Houston was a huge star, a megastar, one of the biggest of her generation, and always a source of tremendous interest because of her enormous gifts and her beauty. There must be other books about her.
There are. And since her death 2 months ago, there have been a few more that have come up. One of them most recently was just last week. The gospel singer Bebe Winans signed a deal to write a memoir about her. That book is called The Whitney I Knew. And it is apparently going to capture a lot of personal stories about her, anecdotes that Bebe Winans said will reveal Houston's warmth, generosity, and humor. And that will come out this July. It's being published by a small Christian publisher in Nashville. So that also doesn't seem like a tell-all kind of book.
The decision of co-author or ghostwriter is so important in these books. You think how, for instance, Andre Agassi's memoir may be a kind of classic in part because he's so fine a writer. Do we know how publishers choose ghostwriters? Is there a sort of like vetting or recruitment process, and they send prospective writers to Sissy Houston and she talks with them and chooses the one she thinks will be best? Or does she have her own person in mind? Do we know how this works at all?
Usually, my understanding of it is that the writer often depends on the publisher to, you know, give them several prospective ghostwriters. The publisher is trying to find a writer who will be a good match with the author who will have her name on the book. And usually they just want someone who, you know, will have good chemistry with the author, someone who can really sit down with that author and, you know, get all of the great details out of that person. So it's usually the publisher who has a long list of ghostwriters that they've worked with, that they trust, that they know very well, and they'll make that suggestion to the author and the agent.
And do we have any idea how ghostwriters get compensated? Do they get some of the royalties? Do they get paid a large sum? They do pretty well on a big book like this, right?
They do pretty well. You know, you brought up the Agassiz book. A writer like that is obviously going to make more. You know, there's a scale and there are levels of this, as in with most writers. Keith Richards, ghostwriter, you know, who did an incredible job and some people think was really responsible in large part for the success of that book, will certainly have no trouble getting more work in the future.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, the question of evangelicals is more on people's minds than ever, particularly because of the Republican primary and all the evangelical voters who've turned out. There's an important new book. It's called When God Talks Back: Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. It's by T.M. Lerman and reviewed for us by Molly Worthen, who says, When God Talks Back is remarkable for combining creative psychological analysis with a commitment to understanding evangelicals, not merely as a scholar's specimens, but on their own terms. The result is the most insightful study of evangelical religion in many years. I'm delighted that Tanya Lerman is here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's high praise. So let's get to it here. How did you research this book? You lived among them. Is that right?
In a manner of speaking. I went to church for 2 years in a Vineyard Christian Fellowship in Chicago. And during that period, I also joined a house group, which is a weekly meeting of members of the church. I went to regional conferences. I went to retreats. I interviewed people. I had coffee with them. I then moved out to California and did pretty much the same thing with another Vineyard church in the area. And this time joined a prayer group and then a different prayer group and spent a lot of time talking to people. I also ran an experiment in which I was so intrigued by what I thought I saw about prayer that I wanted to confirm my ethnographic observations. I ran an experiment in which I randomized people into prayer and lectures on the Gospels and looked to see what happened to them.
Okay, now first, what sect or denomination is the Vineyard Group? Why did you choose them?
So I was looking for a kind of religiosity which I thought represented the big shift in American spiritual experience since about 1965. The evidence is pretty clear that Americans have wanted a more experiential relationship with God, and it's also pretty clear that they've shifted towards a more sort of evangelical style religiosity. So the Vineyard Christian Fellowship is only, you know, one particular church. Let's be clear, God is different from church to church. God is different from congregant to congregant. But this Vineyard takes the experiential richness that's available through Pentecostalism, makes it tolerable to middle-class white Americans, and it, looking at the numbers, the kind of practice, the kind of intimacy they seek with God, the interaction they seek with God, is sought by something like a quarter of all Americans.
Now, and those are the numbers one hears, like 23, 25%. That's also the numbers who vote in elections and all the rest. They're huge component of our culture. Why 1965, first of all? And second, you've mentioned white middle-class people. Tell us as specifically as you can who some of these people are. But let's start with the year 1965, time of upheaval in America.
Huge
is that
social
what?
Upheaval. Americans have sought for God intimately, more or less intensely, over the course of our history. So there have been three, maybe four great awakenings. Many people call this period of post-1965 American experience the fourth great awakening.
And you agree, right? You think it is a great awakening.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about the great awakening. See, these were enormous spiritual movements that really go back to the origins of the Republic.
That's right. These are different times when Americans sought to touch the divine here on earth, to feel God sort of stroke their cheek, touch their shoulder, enter their body. Sessions where people would find the Holy Spirit move through the congregation and knock them over. Different ways of experiencing God were cultivated in these different periods. So in describing 1965 as new, I'm contrasting it not with the entire period of American history, but with the calm 50s and 40s and 30s. There was something that changed in the 60s where people wanted to experience things differently, intimately, personally, immediately. And this kind of God that the Vineyard seeks for has its roots in the hippie Christians who, in effect, traded out LSD for God.
Tell us more about these hippie Christians. They're not all hippies now.
Certainly not. Absolutely not. So one of the great untold stories is the way in which the left-wing hippie Christians became the right-wing evangelical Christians. Not all evangelical Christians are right-wing. Now, something like two-thirds of the evangelical voters voted for McCain in the last election, but that means like a third of them voted for Obama. So it's a much more complicated, messy world than many Americans imagine.
And we're talking about middle-class people often, but good jobs, educated.
Yeah. So the people that I saw were, in fact, more racially diverse than and ethnically diverse than white middle class. But in the churches where I spent time, there were Stanford professors. There were Chicago medical fellows. There were people in medical school and law school and business, somebody doing a mathematics PhD, people working at Google, people working at Yahoo, smart, competent people.
These are not marginalized outsiders.
This is not the lunatic fringe. These are people who are fully mainstream, very sophisticated, often reading the New York Times, often engaged in the world. They don't feel exactly like the folks I know in the heart of Texas. And that's kind of makes them more interesting because it forces the reader or forces somebody like me to ask, okay, well, how do you live a supernaturally real life in a contemporary modern world?
What are some of the rituals or behavioral patterns of this kind of evangelical Christianity?
You are invited to experience God as by your side, like a person and like a best friend. God retains his holy majesty, his mightiness, his role as an explanation of the cause of the universe. The pastor tells you to set out a second cup of coffee for God in the morning. So it makes it easier for you to talk to God over your coffee. People sometimes go on date night with God. They walk down to the park. They pick up only one Subway sandwich. They sit on the bench. They imagine God's arm around their shoulders. They're kind of cuddling with him. They're talking about, as people describe it to me, you know, I'm talking about my day and I'm asking him about his day. People seek to experience God as a person talking back.
And do they hear him?
Yeah. That's really what the book describes, the way people learn to hear God speak. I'm an anthropologist. I don't have the authority to say that God was or was not present. I don't feel that my discipline can say anything about whether God is really real.
Well, Tom, this raises another question, which is that we're living in a period of intense religious debate. And
yes.
And with many, some say, believing atheists, right? Devout atheists challenging any authority or usefulness of religion in public life. And our reviewer, Molly Worthen, says one of the enormous contributions of your book is it makes us think very hard about the arguments we've heard from the late Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, or some others who really have no respect or comprehension of religion at all.
3 out of 5 Americans pray every day. It is important to understand what they're doing. And it's hard to imagine a practice like religion. Admittedly, religion has done some terrible things in the world. There's been terrible consequences of politically held beliefs by people who take them to be devoutly associated with the Word of God. But this is something that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Christianity has a 2,000-year history. People engage in prayer. It's really important to understand what it's doing for them. It's got to be doing something useful. And unless we understand what that usefulness is, unless we understand how people experience God, I don't think we understand the people. I actually don't think that you can understand the politics unless you understand the way that people experience God.
Now, Tanya, this also reaches out. It has other implications that, as we've said, particularly in an election year, people are very conscious of. I saw statistic recently that almost exactly 50% of voters in the Republican primaries and caucuses, of a total of some 11 million, 50% are evangelicals. Mm-hmm. How does politics figure into this great awakening?
Well, there is this story about the way that the left-wing hippies became the right-wing evangelicals, and that is a long and complicated story. What I have to contribute is that if the Democrats want to reach evangelical voters, Democrats often think in terms of outcome. If we criminalize abortion, there will be many women who will get illegal abortions and they will die. That's a terrible outcome. When evangelicals think about politics, they think about who they want to be and what choices a good person will make. That's not about outcomes. And so when I see these kind of political conversations, it's like there are ships passing in the night. The Democrats don't get the way that the evangelicals
explain that, the person they want to be. Explain what you mean by that.
They want to enact policies that will embody the character of the person they should be. Being evangelical is all about being a certain kind of person, allowing the prayer experience to make you into somebody who is more godlike, to replace your inner imagination, your faulty, human, fearful, scared imagination, with thoughts that come from God, words that come from Scripture. You're aiming to model, you're all the work of prayer is building up this representation of God that you take to be a more wonderful, wiser, moral person than yourself, and then allowing that to model who you should be. That's the way that culture and politics should work.
Thanks so much, Tanya. That's T.M. Lerman, whose new book, When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
Anything cool, hot, new this week?
Well, on the fiction side of things, at number 7, we have a new book by Iris Johansson, probably the only bestseller whose title comes from Nietzsche. The name of the book is What Doesn't Kill You. That is a standard CIA thriller. Then at number 4, Stuart Woods is on the list with a book called Unnatural Acts. It's a law thriller. Number 2, Nora Roberts has her 200th published novel debuting on the list at number 2. It's called The Witness. And David Baldacci has the new number 1 title called The Innocent. And it's getting some really good reviews. People say he's back to form. It's his best book since Absolute Power, which is the one that kind of made his reputation.
So Nora Roberts and her 200th book. My gosh, she's up there with Balzac and Asimov and Joyce Carol Oates and whoever else.
She's really quite amazing. She has told interviewers she takes about 45 days to write a book. She just sits down, writes it out, sets it aside, and maybe takes a day or two, and boom, is on to the next one. And she writes at a faster pace now than she did early in her career. She started writing her first novel. She started it in 1979, and it wasn't published until a couple years after that. And if she were writing at the 45-day pace back then, she'd be close to her 300th book by now. So it's really just as she's kept going, she's gotten better at it. She's gotten faster at it.
So she's gone from being this kind of laborious, glacial, painstaking perfectionist to this rapid-fire machine.
What she's really done in the romance world is bring in the strong, sassy heroine instead of the passive protagonist. She's not unlike Janet Ivanovich in her use of humor and sassiness, and also her use of suspense. The Washington Post profiled her recently in connection to this 200th book, and she told them that her books probably have about the same number of orgasms and corpses.
That works. And nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, there are just two new books this week. At number four, a book by a couple of editors from Time magazine, Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy, called The President's Club, where they look at the relationships between living presidents of the U.S., so including the current president, but also the relationships between all of the ex-presidents.
Right. I saw an excerpt in Time magazine, which they both write for. So you see Obama and Jimmy Carter or Clinton and the Bushes.
Right. The way that they turn to each other for whoever the sitting president is, it's often for counsel or just for companionship, because the idea is that the ex-presidents are the only one who really only ones who really understand the burdens of being a sitting president. But also as sort of a de facto cabinet, what would you do about this? And so Obama has had all of the ex-presidents come sit in as kind of a sounding board for him at various times. Carter has gone off to do missions for him that, you know, kind of top secret foreign diplomacy missions.
And if I remember, it was actually Herbert Hoover who kind of helped begin all of this.
Well, the authors say that you know, it goes all the way back to Washington, and that when John Adams took over, he turned to Washington both for military counsel, because Washington, of course, was a great general, and to help guide him through the presidency itself. So that there have always been sort of clubs of ex-presidents.
So anything else in nonfiction?
Yes. At number two, the blogger Jenny Lawson has a book called Let's Pretend This Never Happened. That's a memoir mostly lifted wholesale from her blog. She grew up in rural Texas in kind of an eccentric family. And so these are David Sedaris-type essays about growing up. Her father was a professional taxidermist, and she tells stories about she collects little stuffed animals. I don't mean stuffed animals. I mean
animals that have been stuffed.
Yes, killed stuffed animals. The cover of the book is a mouse wearing a purple cape, a little Shakespearean mouse.
Oops, there goes my next book jacket. All right, somebody had to come up with that idea first. All right. All right. And what stories does she tell? Is she a good writer?
She's a very funny writer. She writes very naturally. She talks about her current family, her husband and her children. She talks about her vagina. There's a whole chapter in there. She talks about growing up with the taxidermists. Very kind of slice of life, quirky. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.